Okay, so thank you. And for those of you, welcome to those in the class and for those of you online. So this course is made up of a number of components. We take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment, first of all. Then I actually begin the course. And during the course, there's breaks for questioning and for meditation. So let's begin. So first of all, you guys need to all get comfortable in your seat. So just adjust your posture until your spine has been elongated, your shoulders are relaxed, and your hands and feet are in a comfortable position. Now, if you like, you can close your eyes completely. Otherwise, have them partially open so a little bit of light comes in. And then let your body breathe itself. With the body relaxed and the mind stable and concentrated, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he's sitting on a golden throne. And he is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, meditational deities, Arahats, solitary realizers, and protectors. Meanwhile, all sentient beings surround you, with everyone facing the Buddha and his entourage. Recollect that everyone has an equal wish to avoid suffering, equally wishes to be happy, and equally lacks genuine happiness. Whatever blocks genuine happiness, which you call suffering and its causes, these can be eliminated. Meanwhile, the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. Decide to lead all the beings who surround you, all the sentient beings, in going for refuge to the Buddha, his Dharma and his community, with a wish to put an end to suffering and its causes and to develop all good qualities leading up to Buddhahood. Affirm your wish to guide all sentient beings into the state of absolute freedom. Join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the sins of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the sins of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the sins of the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I think that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream forth and wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And all obstacles to your enlightenment vanish. Having no intrinsic nature, they cannot exist forever. In fact, they're undergoing continuous change right now. You think that your potentials of method and wisdom have been empowered, and you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these qualities yourself and then to help everybody else do the same. Now, to affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the vast attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. They wash over you and all sentient beings who surround you. And the lights and nectars remove obstacles and empower your potential to become enlightened. Recollect the field of merit above you. And you prepare yourself to purify the mind, to accumulate more merit, and to increase that merit. And so you say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present cards of every type, offering, actual and imagined. I declare all negative actions accumulated since being this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary deeds. Just pause here, just pause. And remember somebody who's done something virtuous and good, and allow yourself a moment to think, just to rejoice in that virtue. Now, we rejoin, saying to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas above us, the field of merit, please remain until the end of cycle differences and turn to your Dharma to the beings. I dedicate my own enormous merits to the great enlightenment. Now we're going to offer a mandala next. So we do this recollecting our emptiness, but all phenomena lack an independent nature and therefore exist dependently. So we're recollecting that subtle dependent arising. The phenomena exist depend upon consciousness and name. Imagine that your body, speech, and mind, all virtues you've created, every object of your senses is utterly transformed and reappears as a pure land. Do you want to offer this to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas? And say along with me, this ground, the motive of perfume, stirs the flowers, the dawn of Mount Mary, four consciousness, the sun. I imagine this is for the field of offering. May all the beings enjoy this pure way. The offering has been made, and the Buddha accepts us with joy, and he smiles at you. Now look up and meet the smiling gaze of the Buddha. Feel accepted and at ease, and feel confident that whatever you wish to attain, you will accomplish. And now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing the same direction you are. Now the emanation descends down to the level of your heart. And it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light, which pours out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. Allow a sense of conviction to arise that you've accomplished the two purposes. And then notice the withdrawal of the light rays from the 10 directions of space. And they withdraw back into your heart center. And then you can hear ordinary sounds. You can feel the texture of the seat you're sitting on. You know you're embodied. And you understand that the meditation you've done was one of imagination. Yet the imagination has imprinted the mind with conditions to bring about your enlightenment. I think that these conditions are present, but you need other conditions, and also you have the cause within you to become enlightened. So one of the other causes you need is to have an authentic spiritual teacher. And you need to rely upon them with faith. This is something we want to do, and this is something we wish to study. And then breathe it in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And gratefully just let your eyes flutter open. Move your body, your limbs, whatever like you like, and make yourself aware once again in the place. Sorry, I did not do the mantra. That's my fault. Okay, let's have a look at what we've already covered. We began by looking at our need for a teacher, and there was a reason given. Can anybody remember the reason? We need to rely upon a spiritual mentor because we have not yet gathered the two accumulations, nor have we purified the two obscurations. So try to remember this. There's two things we're trying to get rid of, and two things we need to gather in. So the two accumulations we're trying to gather into ourselves is all the methods and the wisdom realizing emptiness. And what we need to get rid of are the two obscurations, afflictive and cognitive. Thank you. Excellent. So we do need a teacher to do that. We don't actually know how to do that at present, but we're learning. There are many different teachers need different types of qualities, and teachers themselves are different. Sometimes we need to begin with a Buddhist professor doing your trainings and so forth, or need someone to help you train with instruments, a ritual master. You need to find people who will make you a Buddhist by giving you the Buddhist vows and refuge, it's not refuge master. We need Mahayana masters, Tantra masters, and so forth. Now, each of these teachers, of course, has different roles, and they'll have different types of students there. Sometimes you'll have a teacher that plays all those roles. There are 10 qualities of a Mahayana guru, and we looked at 5 qualities of the student. So can anybody remember what the 5 qualities of the student are?
Non-biased.
Non-biased. Intelligent. Chris, what's for G? Greatly diligent. What's for A?
Attentive.
And last one, R, is respectful. Yeah, that's good.
I thought it was a spectre. Nigra.
Yeah, you can go the other way too. Okay. It's up to you, whichever way you'd like to go. I think it's just to remember it. Okay, we know that the Mahayana master has 10 qualities. Deb, what are the first 3? Discipline. What's discipline. Next?
Oh. I think I've got a chart. They have
serene.
To know more than us.
Serene, thank you. Next one.
Sorry,
pacified. Sorry, pacified. Right. What do these 3 relate to?
3
higher training. Thank you.
Spiritual knowledge.
Okay, we'll just look like that. So we have these other major 3. Then the teacher also has to know more than the student, has the wealth of scriptural knowledge and all knowledge of reality itself.
Does the teacher have to be ethical, honest, kind?
Yes.
Well, that's the first one. Disciplined. The first one. Okay. Okay, now, and then we looked at some of the benefits of devotion. I said last week I'm going to ask you some questions about this. Right? So put your text down. Deb, just give me one of the faults of not being able to rely upon an authentic teacher.
One of the faults of the student.
Yeah, one of the problems you're going to meet if you rely wrongly upon the spiritual teacher.
If you criticize the guru,
like you
criticize the teacher.
Well, you can say, and what's the problem with that?
The fact that you're not going to be learning from that teacher or being respectful of that teacher. So
the often says if you criticize your teacher, you criticize all the Buddhas. You criticize the guru, you criticize all the Buddhas. Okay. Ben, what's another fault?
Your Realizations are delayed?
That's dead right. That's a good one. Realizations are delayed if you have a poor relationship with the teacher. Chris, can you think of
it? What I remember is the knowing
knowledge. Knowing knowledge. This is, yeah.
But it's a spiritual teacher.
You won't have a spiritual teacher in future lives. That's right. Okay, so these are some of the faults. A benefit. What's the benefit of relying upon a spiritual teacher?
All good qualities will quickly come.
Excellent. Yeah, good, good. Positive qualities flourish. That's right. Ben, what's a good quality?
You receive blessings.
You receive the blessings. Excellent. Ian?
Can't think of it.
Anymore. Okay. Chris?
You're protected from evil friends.
Yeah.
We're protected from delusions.
Georgie says, benefit, we protect our merit.
That's right. That's another good merit. Thank you, Georgie. Yeah. Okay, great. So please don't forget them. I'll ask you again. So gradually over time. So I think sometimes you need a little bit of pressure on it. Unless otherwise, yeah. You know, we sit here, we all agree, it's all great, and we come out and it's true. So, okay, so that's what we've looked at so far. And I'm just going to ask you, like each week as we go through, quickly just what qualities of the teacher, student, subject, and each of these things. And hopefully the knowledge will be retained over time. Now, the books, of course, haven't changed at all, I think. Now, maybe this bottom one, Son of Devotion, Stream of Blessings, is a sort of a newish one. But most of the questions from this teaching today are really coming from versions related to a spiritual teacher, sometimes called wise teacher, wise student. That's the newest iteration of the text. And next one is one up here by Lama Zopa, The Heart of the Path, I think it's called. Yes, The Heart of the Path. So that goes into a lot of detail about what we'll be talking about today. So the topics tonight are basically these attitudes of the student. We're still looking at that. And it's training in faith, and in particular, seeing the guru as a Buddha. The Lama Tsongkhapa uniquely prioritized this topic called guru devotion. So what's the word guru mean? Heavy with good qualities. Yeah, so guru is, yeah, that's heavy with good qualities. So guru is heavy with good qualities. And here's the meaning of devotion. So the Tibetan word for devotion is called Tenpa. So you might have met one of the students. It's called Venerable Tenpa.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just Tenpa means devotion. So devotion means to come close to someone in one's thought and actions. And then to rely upon that person with confidence. This is what it means in the Tibetan tradition, this word tenpa that we call devotion. So about this term, Berzin says, the Tibetan term tenpa sums up a healthy relationship with a spiritual teacher. The usual English translation is devotion, hence the term guru devotion. Devotion, however, carries a misleading connotation. It conjures the picture of a devoted servant or a devotee of a god or a cult. It also implies a combination of emotional fervor and mindless obedience. So this is yeah, the word you might think of devotion like that. You can see it's not what it means in the Tibetan tradition. Here it means to come close to someone in one's thoughts and actions and to rely on the person with confidence. It does not imply, however, coming close to a charlatan or a scoundrel or relying neurotically on someone, even if the person is competent to help us. He says, thus, I have translated here as building a healthy relationship. And I think that's what Geshe-Tashi Sering meant. He said, he kept saying, it's not the guru, it's the relationship. We all think, I've just got to rely upon the guru, right? Devote myself to them. No, it's, you have to relate to them in this close, meaningful, useful way. So there's a text called according to the text, difficult points concerning helping and showing respect to a guru Devotion or temper also connotes pleasing one's guru in the proper manner. The proper or healthy way for disciples to please their teachers is to come close in the sense of modeling themselves after their teachers and following the advice of the teacher to transform their minds and help all beings. Now, this has come from, this is on page 137 of this book related to a spiritual teacher or wise student, wise teacher. So I'll come back to this again and use it to maybe highlight some of the more difficult points. Again, like since I've read this book, I always recommend this book for students who talk, when it comes to this topic, this is the book you need. Then you can go and grab all the other stuff like that, like Lama's Opus books and things like this. This prints you really good overlay. And then Lama's Opus, they go into specifics and details. This does that too, but in a quite a readable, easily understandable way. So we're going to begin with looking at faith. And there are a number of, faith has this type of like an outline, but the outline has come from Geshe Tashi theory. Because when you look at the text, there's no actual outline to study this topic, faith. So here's what you see. You look at faith and its benefits, then following on from that, because the faith that we're trying to develop here is to see your teacher as a Buddha. The first begins with what faith is and its benefits. Then it talks about the reasons to perceive your teacher, the guru, as a Buddha, the necessity of doing so, then how to develop that perception. And lastly, appearances are deceptive. And following off with appearances are deceptive and your own opinions are not reliable. Yep, that'll all come up in the spin. Yeah. So let's look at what faith is first of all. Faith is a doorway through which all positive qualities manifest. Now, of course, it's got a particular definition for it all, but I've just left that off just to make it quite easy for us. So faith in Buddhism expands understanding and cultivates positive qualities. It contradicts disbelief, non-admiration, and non-wishing. These are terms, non-admiration, non-wishing, non-belief. They're the opposites of faith. And so in the definition, they often say faith is the opposite of belief. No belief, no wishing, and so forth. Now, the faith that they talk about here is not often it's not blind belief. That's the first thing you should understand. Often when we hear the word faith, we don't think of it. You think, I just have to believe something. I don't really know, but I'm going to believe it. That's what's required of me. So in Buddhism, that's not the case. Even though oftentimes when we begin, there are things we just have to take on faith. We don't know yet, but we can find out. So the Buddha says, faith is the prerequisite of all good qualities, a procreator of them, like a mother, who then protects and increases them. It clears away doubts, frees you from the four rivers, and establishes you in the prosperous city of happiness and goodness. So another term for the word faith is confidence. So if you find that faith is a little, you don't like that word because it connotes this blind belief. How about the word confidence? Change it over. Trust is another. You could hear trust. Trust, yeah, trust it. So authentic confidence is a clear, reasoned trust that acts as an eternal guardian, shielding the mind from the four destructive currents of cyclic suffering. So what are the four currents? Does anybody know? Yes, from so we've got the four currents. You can look at them from two points of view. One is the causal current, or then the effect current. So the effect current is birth, aging, sickness, death. Then in terms of the causes, you have karma, you've got ignorance, you've got a few other things as well. Now there are three levels of faith. And they are called inspired faith, aspiring faith, and convictional faith.
I'm sorry, Eddie, would you mind just stepping back? This is the four rivers referred to in that quote, is it? It clears away doubts, frees you from four rivers.
Yep.
And those rivers are can either be
birth,
four effect rivers, which four, are birth, aging, sickness, death.
And four causal rivers, the things that bring about those four.
And what are they? Karma.
Well, you've got like, well, ignorance as well, the afflictive emotions as others. You can put it into the AI.
Okay.
Ask yourself, you'll find out.
All right.
Yeah, what's river of sensual, river of craving, distorted views from a causal point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Like ignorance and so forth. Now, these three levels of faith that I've written up and called inspired, aspiring, and the faith of conviction also have different names in different texts and who the teacher is. So Geshe Toshi Seren used to use the word clear faith. And the clear faith was for this one of the faith of conviction. So this is what he would mean by it. And why does Kabbalah become through actually through reasoning and seeing the object, so it's clear that this is somebody I can depend upon in terms of faith. Well, let's have a look at, I'm going to take each one of these first of all. So, inspiring faith. I'll just go back. I went straight to the most important one. So, just briefly about each of these, right? So, inspiring faith or inspired trust. So, this occurs when we encounter a person of great qualities, sort of peaceful person, and feel an immediate sort of joyful admiration for their qualities. So, this can easily happen to you. So many times we have visiting teachers and we know nothing about them, right, other than what's in the blurb. Then they come in and you go to meet them and you can feel something. If you feel something, this is inspired trust or inspired faith. But just get that feeling about it. You don't know much about them at all, but this is what happens to you. And this is the aspect that's a bit of blind faith is involved in this. Right? You don't know much. It's really based on if the feelings are arising. Now the second, aspiring faith, so that's quite straightforward. You go, wow, they're tremendous. I like to be like them. So you aspire to have the same qualities of the person that you've just met. Now, convictional trust or convictional faith. So this is like the deepest faith, and what Kinsir Rinpoche used to call clear faith. It's built on logic, reasoning, and personal testing. And once this is done, and you are, like I say, you clearly see that this person has these qualities and so forth, it doesn't matter what other people point out to you about them, you're not going to lose faith in that object. As I say, you are convinced. Now, if somebody can throw you off the object, you'll have to know, okay, my logic or reasoning is not very strong, is it, in terms of this, developing trust in this person. So basically, this is convictional trust. It's the most important for us because the qualities of the guru are evident to us. And isn't that what we do when the teachers come in and watch them, don't we? We see how they behave. And then you might find, oh, they've done this many retreats. Oh, they've studied for this long. You know, and so this helps us to be convinced that this is a person we can trust. Now, this type of convictional faith or clear faith is the most crucial type because it dispels doubts and establishes a stable trust in the teacher and the teachings. Now, another word they use for inspired faith is admiring trust. You admire the person, then you aspire to be like one, like them, and then you are convinced you can be like them. There's a progression of deeper and deeper faith, deeper and deeper trust. So this part where you have the wishing faith. The aspiration is the basis for joyous perseverance. So when you're like, you know, you want to wish to be like somebody, well, you're going to have to try to be like that, aren't you? And so you will keep on going. And it's a sort of a joyful passage, because you should realize it's possible. And again, from the Buddha, a quote from the Buddha, he says, faith is the best of vehicles through which you will be guided and definitely emerge. So again, you can see here, so this is you saying guidance, so we need guidance to get out of the cycle of uncontrolled experiences that we undergo. So this is this term here, definitely emerge. This is like to renunciation, liberation. Therefore, intelligent people rely on following faith. Wholesome qualities do not grow in people who have no faith, just as green sprouts do not grow from seeds scorched by fire. So anything difficult in the quote that you...
What is the metaphor of that last? What is that implying?
So suppose you want to grow something, and you get a seed, and you get like a blowtorch and scorch it, and now put it in the ground and expect it to grow.
So I understand the literal meaning of what's it referring to?
Well, so we have the seed of enlightenment within each of us. We have the possibility of it, right? But suppose we're not convinced that you can actually become a Buddha. This is what it's saying.
That's our blind talk.
Yeah, well, that's it. This doubt, this lack of faith is the thing that burns our potential and stops it from fully flourishing. Yeah.
No, you're not. But what it is, though, it's the outer covering of the seed that gets burned. The actual seed kernel itself doesn't get affected. It gets released by burning off the outer layer. Although sometimes with some native seeds, you scratch them with sandpaper or other sort of things like that, and it's because native seeds have such a tough layer on the outside to survive in the climate, but the seed itself is protected.
I think that clarification has always been something I've thought
of. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Is this sort of what's interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're talking, isn't it? Talk about the seed, right? What else, Fred?
Oh, I've brought this up before when we've had this subject, this module before. The word faith to me, the semantics of that suggests that you don't fully know it, so you have to, hence leap of faith, like you don't fully know it, so that's why you have to have faith, because you don't actually have the realization or knowledge of it.
So that's what we call blind faith, right? And part is an aspect of it.
But if you have this clear faith, if you know something, then is it even faith?
Well, that's what I call it, faith. We call it faith in English, right?
Mm.
Like I said, if you look at the Tibetan word, it won't be faith, it'll be something else.
Right.
So that's called tenpa.
Yeah, yeah.
Like devotion. The faith in devotional faith.
In the way we... I get what Ben's saying, that it's like if it's a dead seven...
If something's dead certain, like you know exactly how it actually is, I'll get right into the bang, it's going to happen. Versus, I don't fully know, so I have to faith, because I only half know it all.
But remember, the relevant is for faith is trust.
Yeah.
Mm. So now use the same other thing with trust.
When I trust someone or something,
yeah.
I don't fully know if it's going to hurt me or not hurt me, or I don't fully know that.
So when do you fully know? What's the word for fully know? For? And you can also have faith in that it does. Because why? Because you did all the experiments.
Yeah, right.
And that is the same thing with the last one thing, because you do the experiments. You do the reasoning.
If you know something, you don't have to have faith in it. You just know it. Like, whereas if you have faith in something, you're leaning towards, I don't quite know what the path is, whatever. I need to rely on something else. I have to have faith in something else. Or a teaching.
Well, then I would suggest you change the word, as Venerable Gendon said last time. If you have this sort of doubt, and you go like that, you're like, okay, you need to change it, because that's a stumbling block for you.
And our confidence.
Yeah. But I've got confidence this chair's not going to break, but I don't 100% know it. Because it's breaking it out.
Well, you need to, well, it's also true that the chair is impermanent. That it will fall apart someday. Right? So you should have no faith at all that the chair is going to be stable forever.
Yeah.
Right? But you can have faith that, depending upon all these conditions, it should be able to support your weight. Like I said, again, you guys are all coming back to this thing of blind faith. And so the word you're getting stuck on is just like faith, right? I don't know.
But even if I have clear, like even if I have this conviction of faith, I still don't, like it's degrees of knowing. Like I, blind faith, don't know at all. Wishing faith, I know a bit more. I want to be like that.
Well, you know a bit more, and you know a bit more, you want to be like that.
Yeah.
So now how are you going to be like that?
And you're like that.
Well, once you know that, you should have, because you're not like that yet, are you? So, but you have to have faith that you could be like that.
Yeah.
Just like you have faith before you sat on that chair, it's going to hold your weight, right? Even though you're not absolutely sure. So you're never ever absolutely sure until you become enlightened.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Some,
so it's conventional.
Right.
It's okay. This is the thing. This is what the words do to us. Yeah, so the, what they call the fear, sorry, clear faith or the faith of conviction has arisen through reasoning. The other two, not so much. Because like I said, when the first one comes in, you just feel something. Their good qualities affect you. You yourself then wish to become like that. And then this, the third one, you've got to go, well, can I? Because if that, if you're not clear about that, then you're, like you're saying, it's just on faith. And mostly blind faith, because you don't know it. And so we've got to bring in, this is why for, especially the Gurdjieff tradition, probably in the others too, why reasoning is so important. Why love is not, always comes back to reasoning. Okay, let's do a meditation. Continue. So just get your body settled. And relaxed. And let your breathing find its own natural, even rhythm. Then bring to mind an altruistic intention to do this meditation. Now become curious about the true source of unshakable inner confidence. The actual confidence or real confidence is not blind belief, of course, but it's a clear certainty built on reason and experience. When this insight is understood, you stop drifting through life and you gain a sort of steady direction. The clarity and calmness of your mind becomes apparent to you. Now ask yourself, where do you presently look for safety when life becomes difficult and uncertain? So true safety is found by relying on wisdom and the reality of cause and effect. Like finding some sturdy shelter in the middle of a storm. But how can you grow this clear certainty inside your own heart, inside your own mind today? So you grow it by focusing on the good qualities of those who are kind and wise. And this focus acts like a sort of brilliant light that clears away the fog of hesitation. So commit yourself to checking your choices with clear reason during your daily activities. If you do this, you can rest in the warm, supportive feeling of unshakable certainty. Breathe in through nostrils, exhale. Okay, so now this next, so now we're going to move into this idea of how to see the teacher as a guru. And it's got a number of different parts to it. And as Lama Zopa said, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, they start off with Vajradhara is asserted that the guru is a Buddha. He, Lama Zopa, suggests putting this, reversing it for Westerners. This is for the Tibetans, this done deal, that's what they, yep. But for Westerners, this is not a reason, this is not a good reason. And in fact, it's a very difficult reason for Westerners to get their head about, as Mr. Berzin suggests reading this. But some of the stuff will settle much easier with us and others won't. I don't know what to do about that. I think other than become a monastic and actually all hear really good teachers explain it to you. Perhaps that's what might be required. But let's have a look at the four reasons. So first of all, it says there's nothing to trust in your own views. Second is, even nowadays, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are still working for sentient beings. Then the guru is the doer of all the Buddha's action. And finally, Vajradhara asserted that the guru is the Buddha. So in brief, this lineage of wisdom offers four reasons to view an authentic teacher as an embodiment of ultimate potential. First, our own subjective views are inherently unreliable. We constantly misjudge people and situations based on our moods. Second, if universal compassion exists in the world, it must express itself through real living people who can speak to us. And third, a mentor acts as the direct channel for this universal wisdom. And fourth, the historical founders of this path explicitly stated that the guide appears in human form to meet us where we are. The author of Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand said, those with certain diseases are mistaken as the objects of their perception. Since the minds of ordinary beings are made defective by ignorance, which projects hallucinations, how is it possible to see the guru as an actual Buddha? So here is sort of, this is leading into this idea, you know, the first heading is nothing to trust in our own view. So this is sort of suggesting that, geez, how are we going to do this? So in brief, Pavanka Rinpoche is saying our contaminated perception naturally projects flaws onto the spiritual guide, making the deliberate practice of pure projection a necessary medicine to clean our own ignorance. So what's going on is sort of like saying that when we see, I was talking about this today actually, I'll use the example today, right? So And I'm sitting in my room, I'm looking out across the road, and I see this person where the red come from. So I ask myself, where's the red? And the answer to myself is in that coat over there. Right? Now that is the view of inherent existence, straight up. Colour seems to be independent of me, it's over there. But as we know, colour doesn't exist like that, does it? If we actually investigate that, we're not going to find red. Why? Because red depends upon the coat, the object over there, the light, and how the light bounces off and goes in through here, does all the changes around. And it's the brain that comes up with red. There's no red over there. Now, this is like, you know, you can understand this scientifically, but boy, if you try and take that and use it in real life, this is very difficult, right? You'll just keep coming back. No, it looks like it's over there, so it's over there. Our behavior has always been, it's over there. Now, in the same way that there's no red over there, the self of other persons is not over there intrinsically either. Nor are the bad qualities of your teacher. All the good qualities. It's all imputed. Yeah, it comes from here and out there. So this is what I'm saying, there's nothing to trust in your own view. We trust that we're not deceived that, you know, the red is over there and all these phenomena existing from their own side. So the red exists from the side of the coat, not from my side. That's what it looks like, doesn't it? All the colours look like they're existing from their own side, right? The brown from the side of the brick, you know, the blue from the side of the scarf. But it doesn't exist like that. That's the appearance. It looks like that, but it doesn't exist like that. That's one of the major things to get your head around. Because if you can't do that, you can't find the object to be negated and you can't get emptiness. And, you know, we can find out that it's not there because you can actually investigate to see if it's there. And, of course, it's, you know, you don't find it there. Now, this is not saying that red doesn't exist or the blue, all that stuff. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're not saying that. The blue and the red exist. They're just not over there. They're not existing over there from their own side. They're existing dependently upon our senses, the light, you know, the object called the coat, all these sort of things. So this leads us, like I said, there's nothing to trust their own view. So what do you see up there?
Yeah, both the old man
with
the
scarf
and the shepherd.
Yeah.
What you can't see with those things is both views at the same time.
No, that's all very shift out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you think you can?
Yeah.
So, in other words, although everything appears to exist objectively in terms of their own nature, without being posited through the power of a subjective mind, they do not exist like that at all. So the subjective mind is the thing that comes up with red. The concept comes up red, isn't it?
Ben? I want to ask a really stupid question. Just
please do.
I want to know, how does that thing exist without my mind looking at it?
Well, suppose you don't look at it, right?
Then I can't.
You can't know, or we can look at it and say, sure, for me it exists, it's right there.
Yeah, but in terms of like, if that blue is in my, it's all dependent.
Yeah.
Take that away. What is? How does the object? How does the color exist without my consciousness perceiving it?
Well, it can't, can it?
I know, but it's like.
Just like you say, look at this blue. Just turn your head and go, can you perceive blue? You go, no. So it depends upon your perception.
But I've got a concept in my head of like, what would it be? What? How does it actually exist without?
They don't know. Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Even this is not the middle way to go. We do not know.
Yeah.
You know, that's the signal. That's the reified thing. I want to know what what's there?
Yeah, what's there without me seeing it?
Yeah.
Like if the tree falls in the forest,
exactly.
And to hear it, does it really fall? You know?
Well, again, you know, you can get three answers to that. It's not a hard one at all. It depends. Always come back to it depends. The simplest thing of all. If you don't do this, you're stuck.
Yeah.
It depends. Mm. So there's three things to say about this. I'm going to just quickly go through them. So the mind, under the power of ignorance, is mistaken, especially what this is pointing out. Right? From the perspective of classical Buddhist epistemology, ordinary sentient beings do not perceive reality as it actually exists. Our minds are obscured by a beginningless habit of superimposing independent inherent existence onto persons and phenomena. That's exactly, like, just like I said, the red's over there, it's independent of my senses. My senses, like, get at the red that's already there. No. Because our ordinary, everyday view is fundamentally mistaken about the ultimate mode of existence, it cannot be trusted as an absolute gauge of reality or spiritual progress. Because this is just saying, not where we are. Then there's the unreliable of changing emotions and projections. Our personal views are heavily distorted by the three poisons, attachment, anger, and naivety. When our self-cherishing attitude or ego is challenged, we naturally project faults onto others, including the teachers, and mistake our own emotional reactions for objective facts. As the Dalai Lama notes, our everyday minds are hard and skeptical. At one moment, everyday minds are hard and skeptical at one moment and devotional the next. A view that fluctuates so wildly based on sort of fleeting conditions is sort of unreliable. And lastly, the need for an objective external gauge. Because we cannot distinctively separate our authentic insights from our ego-driven delusions on our own, we require a qualified external guide who embodies the stable, unclouded wisdom of a Buddha. By shifting our reliance away from our own distorted, habituated viewpoints and looking at the teacher as an embodiment of a complete path, we create the psychological openness which is necessary to break through our own conceptual blind spots. Secondly, there is this necessity. Why do we need to see the teacher as a Buddha? The answer is, this is from Lama Zopa, right? We want a prophet, not a loss. Having the thought that the guru is an ordinary person will cause us to lose the realizations. We often look outside ourselves for inspiration. Yet our minds remain trapped in old habits of criticism and doubt. When you view your spiritual mentor as an ordinary person with flaws, then your heart remains closed like a stone. Transforming how you perceive your guide is not for their benefit, it's for your own growth. So here's a great question you can ask. It says, how would your daily choices change if you treated every piece of constructive advice as a message from an enlightened being? Okay, thirdly, so with this... With a comment on the necessity of sins, they often use Lama Zopa and Alexander Burris and all these people use the example of a magnifying glass. And it only works so well because, like Burris says, Westerners are going to go, hang on a minute, problem. And anyway. He says, think of the sun shining brightly everywhere. Its rays are vast, but without a magnifying glass, you cannot focus that heat to start a fire. A qualified spiritual teacher acts exactly like that magnifying glass. They channel the infinite universal qualities of full awakening directly into your daily life. Yeah, so it's that, you know, we need a teacher to act like that. So even nowadays, all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are working for sentient beings. So I really like this particular saying, and I use it a lot myself. And so how do they do this? Well, they liberate by revealing the absolute true nature. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are constantly working to guide seekers towards enlightenment, you know, the highest goal. In our current age, these enlightened beings manifest as spiritual teachers, providing essential guidance to practitioners on the path. Realizing that one's own teacher is a manifestation of the Buddha is a powerful way to connect with the wisdom and compassion. So one of the things I found very useful to try and, you know, to remember this and make it sort of firm within you is that, you know, one way of saying this is an unborn mind cannot die. Does that make sense to you? A mind that has not been born cannot die. So, and besides, a mind is not a physical thing. Physical things die, but mental, but what can you say about a thing like a mind?
A mind's born?
Good question. They're not.
They don't have a start.
They have no beginning. Not all minds, but this particular mind they're talking about here, this is a mind that has no beginning, right? And no end. It arises itself in Buddhahood, but then it keeps functioning, doesn't it? And what it is, a mind knows objects. So if you think, okay, the mind of all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is still present, just like when we die, right? Of course, this gross mind will come to an end, but the subtle mind won't. And the idea that Eddie still exists has to go out of existence, doesn't it? Eddie goes out of existence. But that subtle mind, without beginning, without end, just keeps on going. And the person is imputed to that. Now, that mind knows objects. So we are all objects that could be known by a mind. Like I can know Ben because I've got a mind, and Ian too, right? So this is just the gross mind. So the very most subtle mind, of which has the quality of being clear and the function of knowing. Well, it's always there. It doesn't go, like, you know, the seven of the Buddhas, the Tathagata, he's not come from anywhere and he's not going anywhere. And that's the same thing with the mind. But this very subtle mind. So then, they're still working for us. That's what the mind does. I mean, this is what you're going to do, is that we're going to become Buddhas. What are we going to do once we're a Buddha?
Help other people
become Buddhas. That's the goal, isn't it? So you just got to think, well, somebody else has done it. All the other people who have done it, they're still working for us. That's what we're trying to do. So, honestly, no, you're never alone. I'm never alone. No way. Why would you feel lonely? So this is why I've gone through years in those prison camps and those jails and those cells. They don't feel lonely. And this is because this is the whole idea of like putting up the merit field. You know, it's like to keep your teachers with you. Remember the story of like Marpa when Marpa sent Milarepa away to go into retreat and meditate. I'll never see you again. You'll never see each other again. And then, Milarepa actually got sort of like lonely. Not lonely, but he realized he'd never see his teacher again. He really missed his teacher, the physical embodiment. And so, like, he started to weep, and then Martha appears to him on this tiger, riding in space. No need to weep, my son. Look, I'm still here with you. You know, I think that's a new pharaoh. Oh, sorry. This one here. The guru is the doer of all the Buddha's actions. The actions of all the Buddhas are received in the mind of the disciple through the guru. The Buddhas manifest in ordinary forms to connect with and guide seekers effectively. Your own spiritual teacher is the most accessible and helpful embodiment of this enlightened wisdom. Therefore, viewing your teacher as inseparable from Buddha Vajradhara can deepen your spiritual practice and understanding. Now, I've got to come to this part in here. Anything interesting that you'd like to bring up?
Georgie had a question.
Okay, yep. That's Georgie's question.
How can we separate attachment from devotion to a teacher? Where do you draw the line, and what should we look for to avoid attachment?
Okay, so firstly, I guess, Georgie, is to know what attachment is. So if you overestimate, you're overestimating something about that object, and you know, there's a sense of clinging to it that you don't want to be separated from it, and so forth. What else was there?
How do we separate attachment from devotion? What to look for?
Well, I get, first of all, clear on the two terms, attachment and devotion. Now, that's the first thing. Then I would look at saying, okay, now, am I attached to my object of devotion? And if you are, well, you know that's attachment. But if you're not, you'll know it's not.
And again, it's just how you define the word.
Yeah, it all comes back to this.
When we say attachment, we mean a specific type of.
In this sense, that you know, an overestimation of the qualities are coming from the side of the object. So if you're doing that, Georgie, you'll know you're attached. No. Buddhas have no qualities from their own side. Oh. Nothing has any qualities from their own side. This is what we've got to keep remembering. Because this is where you get... This is where people got into trouble, right? They thought, all these qualities of the Buddha are from the side of my teacher. Yeah. I need to do exactly what they tell me to. And then guilt when you can't measure up, all the afflictions come up. This is really important. Good question, Georgie.
The impression I get, Eddie, from revisiting this whole issue of seeing our guru as a Buddha,
yeah,
it's actually about what's happening in our own mind.
That's exactly
all right. About our own.
Yeah. In fact, the teacher does not have to be a Buddha at all. In fact, you don't really know he is or not. It's really about the benefit for us.
Yeah.
But when we, you know, like we have to realize we're imputing the qualities to our teacher. The qualities do not exist from the side of our teacher. If you think that's attached, then now you've got attachment problems. There's nothing existing from the side of any object. Those qualities are not there. It's the same thing about the red coat I just said.
But
And our teacher is functioning as the Buddha. Yeah. That's why we can impute the qualities and all the rest of it. Because they meet the function.
If they're misbehaving and sexually.
Well, is this the first thing you've taken as a Buddha or not?
Yeah.
Okay, so now how to develop this perception that the guru is a Buddha? Yeah? So this is what you do, right? So this is, like, I'll put up the first thing to do. The first thing is that it says that we are very familiar with noticing our own good qualities. Yeah. This is what I put down, like the mirror up here, and then you've got, you know, the sort of black person there, but they're looking at it and go, wow, I see myself, I look great. Right? And when you're there, you're primarily looking at your good qualities, how good you look. Yeah. Although, we have many bad qualities too, don't we? We have many good qualities and poor qualities, and none of them intrinsically exist. They all dependently arise. Yeah? But there's a mixture. But here is, even though we have this mixture of good and bad qualities, we're focusing on our good qualities. How's that make us feel?
Good.
That's right. Okay, now
underworld.
Change the object from yourself to the spiritual teacher. So it's another way of saying you're focusing on these, the good qualities of the teacher. And even though the teacher has a number of different qualities, your focus is on the good.
Is this kind of like a change
in self and others type of thing in a way? Maybe later on, or some other sort of thing. But yeah, so I'm just giving this to you very briefly. Right? So I really do recommend, if you can, like grab this book, look through the chapters, find the stuff you're interested in, you can just turn to the page and just read that. There's only a few pages, oh, I got that clear. You can look for the other ones. You don't need to go from front to back sort of thing. Right? So in this, and you also see this, as Holiness has also said, you see, like before you adopt this person as your teacher, like it says, examine their qualities. And of course, you see the teacher has a mixture of qualities. So today, when I was reading this, I was going, like, sometimes some are fat, some are skinny, some might have missing teeth, some might be old, some might be young.
Or have no hair.
Or have no hair, that's right. Or even, shockingly, have a lot of hair. Right? So there's all these sort of qualities. So we need to look at them before we accept this person as our guru. So we understand, yes, there are certain good qualities and certain qualities I don't particularly like. Now, when you do this, you realize, well, we won't, but we should, we need to, the qualities aren't from the side of the object. We're imputing them. They look like they're from the side of the object, like it looks like the red is coming from the coat. So after we've known this, when I impute the negative qualities, what happens to my devotion to the teacher? It goes down or out the window, doesn't it? Whatever, did I just focus on the good qualities I impute? I'm respectful of them, I want to be near them, I want to be like them, all those sort of things. So it's a conscious decision on our part to do this. The person does not have to be a Buddha for you to get a great deal of benefit from seeing the good qualities. Just like, you know, sometimes we look at people who have been married for a long time, we wonder, why are these people married? Right? What do we see? The faults. What do the people see in the marriage? The benefits. Otherwise, they'd be unmarried. There's more benefit there. There's more benefit there than fault, isn't there? Hey, guys, if you see great fault in your husbands, what are you still married to them for?
Well, because it's all temporary.
There you go. Because, okay, there's a benefit because it's temporary, right? So you maintain that on the good qualities. It's only temporary. Therefore, I can bear it. I can stay married to him for years and years and years. Right? Like I said, you go the other way, you leave them.
Yeah.
Same thing with the teacher stuff.
Georgie says, why are you still married? Because it's temporary. They <It'll> laugh.
Could
end at
any time.
Well, that's right.
Okay, so our next thing is Vajradhara says the Guru's Buddha. And like I said, this is a really difficult one until you get to something like this and you can go through it and ask yourself, Like, who's Vajradhara anyway? Any ideas?
Primordial Buddha.
Yeah, simple answer.
Dhammakaya.
The Shakyamuni Buddha. Vajradhara Buddha is Shakyamuni Buddha appearing as a different guise, as they can do. And he appears that way for the tantric practitioners. So when, yeah, so Lama Tsongkhapa does a similar, he says, like I say, you see your teacher sitting here, then you have Buddha at his heart, at your heart, and then at that heart is Vajradhara. And there's these three things you can look at, sort of different levels of the mind too. Like Vajradhara, very subtle mind. He says, seeing a spiritual mentor as an enlightened being can feel deeply confusing or even dangerous to a modern mind. Dr. Alexander Burson clarifies that this advanced practice is not about literal deification or blind obedience, but about training your own mind to recognize its highest potential. Look, I did mark to see how much time I've got to see.
10 minutes.
Yeah. So this is in chapter 11, right? It's called Seeing a Mentor as a Buddha. And it's only, I think, 11 pages of that. With this Vajradhara thing, this is mainly for tantric practice. There's plenty of other things that you can do about seeing a guru as a Buddha and so forth in sutra. So I've got ways of doing it in sutra, ways of doing it in tantra, and shared meanings between the two. So a little bit about from highest tantra. In the context of highest tantra, Buddha nature may refer to the clear light mind. Although each Tibetan tradition explains this differently, they all agree that one aspect of the nature of the clear light mind is that it is the source of all Buddha qualities. Another aspect of its nature as it is empty of existing in impossible ways. Whether the clear light mind is totally obscured, partially obscured, or completely free of fleeting stains, these factual aspects of its nature remain the same. Moreover, whether the Buddha qualities of the clear light mind are only in potential form, are partially operational, or are fully functional, still, the nature of the clear light mind remains the same. In short, the deepest basis for mentally labeling a tantric master as a Buddha is the master's clear light mind. So all of us have a clear light mind. It's always beginningless and endless. That is the basis for Buddha or even person. Because it's this mind that's going to be obscured as it's fully obscured, partially obscured, partially free. It's all still nature, Buddha nature. And like I said so before, this is the continuum that we're imputing identity to. We impute the I to it, an ordinary I, isn't it? But we could also impute Buddha. I think you better all. Ian was saying that reality is a basis, there's something that is to be named. So straight away we have dependent arising. It can't have intrinsic nature if the name and the thing aren't exactly the same, are they? There's two phenomena and the dependent. In short, the deepest basis for mentally labeling a tantric master as a Buddha is that master's clear light mind. The basis for labeling is not the fleeting stains that may or may not be obscuring that mind, nor is the basis the strength of the manifest qualities of that mind. Thus, the mental labeling of a tantric master as a Buddha based on clear light mind is always valid. Mentally labeling our tantric masters as Buddhas based on clear light mind leads to the definitive ultimate meaning of the instruction to see that one's tantric master is a Buddha. seeing that the flaws that appear in our external gurus are dependently arising, fleeting stains, enables us to see that the flaws that appear in our internal gurus, our clear light minds, are also dependently arising and fleeting. This insight is essential for actualizing the Buddha qualities of our own clear light minds. This is according to difficult points concerning helping and showing respect to a guru. Although everyone has a clear light mind, devoid by nature or empty by nature, viewing one's dog as a Buddha does not have the same benefit as viewing one's tantric master as a Buddha. Because, you know, dogs have that clear light mind too, don't they? Therefore, although the clear light minds of our tantric masters are a valid basis for labeling them as Buddhas, their other good qualities, plus the inspiration we gain from them, make the labeling more effective in bringing us insight. The main qualities that may serve as further basis for labeling our tantric masters as Buddhas are their compassion, their mind of enlightenment, and their far-reaching attitudes, meaning the perfections, and the fact of their conferring upon us highest tantra empowerments. So taking this view, taking the idea that you remember that the teacher is Vajradhara, always remember this, the imputation process. Now, it's not Vajradhara from its own side, even though, like I said, the really hard thing to move from the mind, isn't it? But like I said today, that simple idea of looking at a coat and seeing it red and asking myself, which side is the red on? You know, go on that side, the side of the coat. Yeah. There it is, inherent existence. There's the appearance of inherent existence. Ben?
If I'm labeling the clear light mind onto the tantric master versus a dog.
No, you're labeling the tantric master on the clear light mind.
Sorry, I'm labeling the tantric master on the clear light mind of that teacher versus
labeling on the dog.
A dog.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Not true, but isn't that implying that there's something coming from the side of the tantric master that's different from the side of the dog?
But implied, but there's nothing coming from the side. Again, oh, it never comes from the side. How do you know? Because you investigate to see if it's there. If it's there, how would it be there then? It'd be intrinsically one with their body and mind, or intrinsically separate? Because that's how intrinsic nature exists. Yeah, Nugget's in his text, he does that thing, doesn't he, Chris? Where he takes the Buddha. Let's see if the Buddha inherently exists and refutes it. No, Buddha does not inherently exist.
So there's nothing different from the side of the tantric master and the dog.
Hey, yes, there is. There's plenty. A dog can't give a tantric initiation.
Yeah.
God doesn't have, the dog doesn't have body chitta. Any of these things, whereas the master does. Yeah, but as you can see, the dog's much more obscured, right? And even though, yeah, but again, like we're not putting that on the obscured nature.
What about the story of the guy finds a tooth?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Then it turns into the actual Buddha tooth.
Right? No, what happens is the woman, they find that the son finds the dog tooth.
Yeah.
Brings it home and says, Mum, this tooth belongs to the Buddha.
Yeah.
And Mum gets all these great realizations from it.
That's right.
That shows you again that in fact you don't need to have an actual Buddha there. Yeah. You want to read if it's what is your faith that tooth is a tooth of the Buddha.
Mm.
Right? And so she develops all the good qualities. So that one there should really help us again, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. Now it doesn't require actual Buddha. And we can recognize one anyway. But if we think that they actually are, then we get all the benefit. Then we'll relate to them as if they actually are. Okay, next one. So the benefits, of course, are the recognition drives your inner development with a lot of energy and power. And of course, you know, like for many of us, you know, once you take these tantric initiations, right, like again, even in the sutra levels, we benefit, don't we? through our imputational, we suffer through our imputational process, we benefit through it. And then Buddha Vajradhara himself said, which again was Shakyamuni Buddha appearing in a different guise, and Shakyamuni Buddha was really once upon a time a prince. So just these changes. Keep the master's good qualities in mind, never seize upon their faults. Keeping their good qualities in mind, you will reach attainments. Seizing upon their faults, you will not. Again, I'll try and bring this back into practical lived life. You know, you say, keep your wife's good qualities in mind, never seize upon her faults. Keeping your wife's good qualities in mind, you will be happy. Seizing upon their bad qualities, you will not. Right? So just try and find something like that, or relate to your best friend, to your friend, right? Look upon your friend's bad qualities, you won't have a friend for very long.
I think we've just discovered Buddhist wedding vows.
Okay, last meditation. This here, get into a comfortable position, drop your shoulders, let your muscles relax, and bring your full attention to your breath. And feel each gentle rise and fall of your abdomen. Let your mind calm. Now, create an altruistic motivation for the meditation. Now, notice how often your mind can get caught up in judging the faults of others. Notice how that process of judgment can leave you feeling quite heavy, alone and apart from them. But a key to truth is this: choosing to focus on what is good in others unlocks your own potential. When you train your mind to look for the good in your teachers and your spiritual friends, your heart often becomes soft and more open. But what happens when you dwell on someone else's faults and flaws? Well, you start to create a wall of anger that blocks your ability to feel joy and to learn. This is much like how a thick stone wall can keep the morning light out of your room. But how can you view an imperfect guide in a way that will help you grow? You could think that this is teaching me what not to do. Or else we could just look past those faults and focus on the actual wisdom they have to offer. This is a bit like picking sweet fruit from a tree with rough and twisted branches. So the tree might look ugly, but its fruit is not. So a way to develop this for ourselves, find somebody who frustrates you, but acknowledge that there's some goodness within them, something that's wise, kind. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale. So what's our takeaway? So you know about the face. Can you remember the three types of face?
Aspirational.
Excellent. Good, good. That's it. Yep. And you move from one to the other. We aspire and we convict. Yeah, inspire. Excellent. And there are these four reasons we can see, use to see a teacher as Buddha. So what was the last one?
Vajradhara
said so. You don't remember that one. Vajradhara said so. Like I said, if you can, we've got a couple of copies of this book in the library. Like I said, just get out or go up there and have a look at the index, the table of contents. And you can go through it very clean and say, oh, there's that one. And you can just quickly read that. And it's, you know, that's maybe it's 1.5 pages, that's all. It's not very big. But any doubts you might have or any quandaries or queries, you can quickly sort through.
Eddie, the last time we did this unit, I went and bought a second-hand book online.
Ah, yeah.
So I've got that online, but it's maybe not a cheap way to do it. If you say it's on his website now,
yeah, yeah.
PDF.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. 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 Yeah, yeah, when I first read it, I thought, oh my gosh, I wish this was out many years ago, but so many people could have saved themselves a lot of trouble, eh? And there would have been a lot less problems with teacher-student relationships if they had access to it. Okay. So what you can do, so we've got some material up on the site. Of course, you can always go to Burzen Archives. It's called Study Buddhism now, isn't it? It used to be called Burzen Archives, now it's called Study Buddhism. And all this material is up there. And again, you could, what's really nice up there is that you can just put the, you can just query and up it will come very quickly. So next week, we'll have a look at some of the different problems that we might have in our relationship with the teacher and what we can do about that. Okay, so let's dedicate the efforts that we put into that. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Guru, Bodhicitta, not the all arise and grow. May that all have no decline, but increase evermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The prayer for his holiness is long life. The wish granting, wish fulfilling joy, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind tending guests, I beseech that all your wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. In holding and spreading the movie's precious and complete teachings for exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience that was never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for being here, Georgia.